The Glenn Show is brought to you by the Manhattan Institute. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber at glennlowry.substack.com. As a subscriber, you will receive new episodes on Mondays instead of Fridays and get access to exclusive content, ticket pre-sales to live events, monthly Q&As with Glenn Lowry and John McWhorter, and other benefits. Your contribution will also help to fund grassroots initiatives that empower Black development across the country as we donate 10% of our profits to the Woodson Center. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Glenn Lowry here, The Glenn Show. I'm with Michael Schellenberger. I teach at Brown University, and I'm a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, which sponsors The Glenn Show. And Michael is an investigative journalist of some renown. What's your official title these days, Michael?
I have a few titles. I would say I'm the CBR Chair of Censorship, Politics, and Free Speech at the University of Austin. I'm the founder of Public, a Substack publication. And I'm the founder and president of Environmental Progress, which is a research institute that is going to change its name to Civilization Works on May 1st.
That's a lot. UATX, I have a minor affiliation myself. I'm an informal advisor to Panel Canellos and Company, recruited by Barry Weiss and Neil Ferguson and these people. You're actually signing on to a chair there, no?
Yeah, so I'm a chair, and we just bought a house in Austin. We're going to spend at least 3 months a year there. My daughter is graduating from high school in early June, and so I'm an empty nester and looking to a new part of my life. And I've never been in the academy. I dropped out of grad school in the 90s and never looked back, and but always sort of missed the community part of it and the teaching part of it. So I was really happy to get the offer. And of course, that's where you and I met. We met at the University of Austin in Dallas for a summer program. And when I met you, I remember saying, "Got to come to my talk, Glenn Lowry, I want you at my talk." And of course, you came, and that was the first chance that we had really any interaction.
Yeah, it was. I had a great time out there. Forbidden Courses, this program they run in the summer, these amazing kids from all over the world. They were so hungry for knowledge and so interesting. I was well received. I appreciated being so well received and well taken care of. UATX, yeah, that was at the old Parkland Conference Center in Dallas, but you're buying property in Austin. There's a campus. I mean, things are happening.
There's a campus. There's a building. It's a downtown Austin, which is very alive. I mean, I spend a lot of time in different cities, and you know, Berkeley, the downtown is absolutely dead. It's sad. It's shocking. San Francisco downtown, it's a wasteland. It's been taken. I mean, it's just been decimated. Many of the big little shops are leaving. You go to downtown Austin, there's Joe Rogan's comedy shop is there with a big UFO in the front. There's good restaurants, there's good eating, there's amazing barbecue, there's young people walking around. Obviously, there's the University of Texas at Austin, totally separate institution.
Sure.
But University of Austin, they have at least one floor in this building downtown, a great neo Art Deco building downtown, and I think there's more floors available to them, and lots is going on at the University of Austin. It's a real university. I think they've raised $250 million at this point. They have 100 students that are coming in for this fall. So I'm so thrilled to be involved with it and being in at the ground floor. And obviously, I got to meet people like you who, you know, are just like living legends and heroes of mine. So to have the affiliation, very exciting.
Yeah, that's too kind.
True story.
That's too kind.
No, true story. I told you before we talked that listening to you and John McWhorter, who's somebody that I've known for almost a quarter century now and really admire, was listening to you guys during COVID was just a kind of moments of sanity, you know. So anyway, I was really thrilled that you came to my talk there and was just very happy to have this conversation.
your talk was over the top good. I say that as somebody who's heard a lot of talks. Not only was it entertaining and full of information, but you know, it was challenging right across the firing across the bow at the climate alarmism, which, you know, I'll get into trouble for saying this. Hopefully I won't get canceled at YouTube, is a worthy target because these people are off the chain. They want to roll back the clock on modern civilization on behalf of their religious enthusiasm. I know I'm going to get into trouble for saying that, but you had it chapter and verse, and I was really impressed by your talk.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, I'm very interested in this issue of civilization. So we just did a deal with HarperCollins, my colleague Alex and I, to do a third book, and it'll be my third book with HarperCollins, and I view it as a single trilogy of books on the question of why are civilized people attacking and undermining the civilization that they depend on? Why do civilized people hate civilization? And so we're seeing a simultaneous attack on cheap and reliable energy, law and order, and meritocracy. If you don't have those three pillars of civilization, you don't have a civilization anymore. We're also seeing an attack on the pillars of liberal democratic civilization, which I would define as free speech, equal justice under the law, and free and fair elections. And that's terrifying. And so for me, I consider my research work, my intellectual interest, very much around this question of why would civilized people be engaging in what I think is fundamentally irrational behavior, undermining the basis of their own security, prosperity, and status. What's going on with that? What are the psychological, spiritual, and other drivers?
I want to hear a lot more about that, but I'm wondering what the first two books were like in this trilogy. Do they develop the theses that you just got through summarizing?
Yeah, so book one is Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. That came out in 2020. The second book is San Francisco, Why Progressives Ruin Cities. That came out in 2021. And I was supposed to do a third book, and I was just tired, dude. I was tired. I was like, I can't lose my... Sometimes I just like to watch football, soccer, I should say, and movies. But when you write a book like those books, I had to work nights and weekends, and I was just tired. So I gave the book advance back. But the third book in the trilogy, I have this very significant new colleague named Alex Gutentag, who people that know COVID know her because she was a very strong voice on COVID. So she's been helping me to kind of go after the censorship industrial complex for the last year. She said, and she's in her early 30s, so she's full of energy. And she said, let's do a book. And so the third book is going to be called Pathocracy, Why Sick Institutions Hurt Us All, also with HarperCollins. And it's going to really look at these issues that I surfaced a bit in the talk that you heard at University of Austin, which is around this clearly, I think these behaviors that I think are clearly consistent with what you might call cluster B psychiatric or personality disorders, particularly narcissism and psychopathy. So Pathocracy is really building on an argument that was created by a Polish psychologist in a book called Political Ponerology. And so that book is arguing, his book called Political Ponerology argues that totalitarianism is the process of narcissists and psychopaths taking over societal institutions. When you read that book, it's so terrifying because you see this happening across the Western world and our institutions. It has a huge amount of explanatory power. And we thought we need to write this book, Pathocracy, that describes the takeover of these really important institutions and turning them to basically do their opposite, so that there are institutions that are either creating crime or censorship or medical mistreatment or undermining education, institutions that basically are doing the opposite of what they were set up to do.
Wow, that was a lot. Climate alarmism, San Francisco, which is dealing with homelessness a lot, isn't it? And the pathological character of the response of the institutions to the fact of homelessness. And I'm sorry, I don't remember all the buzzword names that you use, but neurotics getting control of the helm here and running us aground. And you think you know what's behind it. And I had a thought. My thought is, whereas you decry the alarmism of the climate alarmist, a person might say there's a kind of alarmism in your diagnosis. I mean, we're in pretty bad shape if you're right. And I'm not sure exactly what you're recommending be done about it, but there's a perhaps somewhat exaggerated sense of doom that I detect in your, I hope you're right.
I hope I'm an alarmist. I mean, I think there's a really reasonable question around how bad is the situation. You know, to give you one number, the percentage of Democrats who want the government involved in censoring so-called misinformation online rose from 40% in 2018 to 70% last year. That's a huge increase of support for censorship.
I'm sorry, say it again. The percent of Democrats who did... I'm sorry, I just didn't hear.
The percentage of Democrats who support government censorship of misinformation online rose from 40% to 70% in 5 years.
Yeah, okay.
As you know, people mostly don't change their mind about anything. I mean, or if you do change your mind, it happens very slowly from your 20s to your 50s over generations. So to see Democrats support censorship in those numbers, I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, so I was born in 71, grew up in the 80s and 90s. We had question authority bumper stickers as lefties on the bumper stickers of our cars. Our parents told us about Skogie, 1977. Supreme Court said neo-Nazis could march through neighborhoods, not just Jewish Americans, Holocaust survivors. Now we have a situation where most Democrats want the government involved in censoring so-called misinformation on social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, now X. That, for me, is absolutely terrifying because the First Amendment is...
I have a theory about that. I mean, I am an amateur in this realm, but I have a theory. And my theory is that the demos has moved right, and the mainstream credentializing information-producing institutions have become discredited. And so a lot of the subversive action of the sort that people who were vaccine hesitant or who might think Trump is not the worst thing in the world is expressing itself in these off mainstream platforms, which the left wants to regulate.
Absolutely.
You know, that's why Elon Musk is a bad guy, you know, need to control this. I mean, the Russia collusion hoax.
Yep.
And all of that. I mean, I'm talking to a Twitter Files guy, so I mean, you should be telling me. but my theory is because of the changing character of the interrelationship between political partisanship on the one hand and the media of the distribution of information, control over what happens at the internet platforms is where the left is fighting its rearguard action. Something like that.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I think that, you know, between 2017 and today, the establishment has said that Donald Trump is going to be a dictator, is threatening democracy. And the only reason people support him is because, A, people are racist, sexist, transphobic, you name it, and B, victims of misinformation. And so in order to save our democracy, we need to have more censorship, and the government needs to be involved in that. But this is a very un-American idea, as you know. you know, I'm not a First Amendment scholar. I'm a real amateur. I'm really learning it for the first time. But what's so striking about it is that the founders of this country, they did not think that free speech was some right that was given to you by the government. As in Europe. In Europe, the king decided what you could, what was the acceptable bounds. And you could petition the king and the king would maybe say, okay, you can have a conversation about those things. That wasn't how the people that came to this country imagined it. They thought that free speech was an inalienable right. It was a fundamental human right. It was not something that was given to us by the government. Many people didn't want to have a country. They opposed unifying the colonies. Unless they knew, and this was the First Amendment was sort of a sop to the people who had the concerns about too much state power. First Amendment was a way of saying, look, you can say what you want to say. It's not up to the government. It's the king doesn't decide. There is no king. The president's not going to decide. The courts aren't going to decide what you can say. It's a fundamental human right. And that has been the view. It really got tested a bit. You know, when the Nazis wanted to march through neighborhoods of Holocaust survivors, you kind of go, geez, you know, how far do we take this? We have very few limits on it. We don't let people lie in order to steal your money. That's considered fraud. We don't let people lie to just absolutely destroy you financially. That's considered defamation. You can't lie in order to commit acts of violence immediately. In other words, the Nazis can march through Skokie, but they can't say, burn that house down or kill those people. That's illegal. I can't threaten you with death. We can't organize. You can't use words to organize violence. But beyond that, you can actually say that America should be a communist country or America should be a fascist country. You are allowed to propose the end of the United States of America. You're allowed to do that under our Constitution. So to have people saying we need to have the government involved in deciding what's true or not on social media platforms.
Okay, Michael.
Is so radical.
I hear you. I'm going to do the devil's advocate thing here and ask. Yeah. Foreign intelligence agents sowing material that is false or defamatory or manipulative into a deliberative process of democratic or a public health crisis. And, you know, the person is in the park shouting out misinformation on a megaphone. Do I arrest him because he's shouting out misinformation? But if he and all of his 100,000 followers are reproducing this misinformation in a viral kind of way, don't I have to somehow regulate or temper the effects of that? It can't be completely laissez-faire, can it? And what does the new technology allow for? What does it require in terms of regulation? We're in a brave new world, kind of thing like that.
Let's take each. Those are the two big examples. So let's take each of them. So let's say that we've got somebody who is spreading Russian propaganda, and they're saying that the Russians are the good guys, the Ukrainians are the bad guys. And let's say we have some evidence that they're actually paid by the Russians or they are Russians. What do you do about that? Some people say, well, we've got to stop them from doing that. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. I don't think so. I don't think the First Amendment supports that. I think what the First Amendment supports is saying that guy's wrong. The Russians are the bad guys. The Ukrainians are the good guys. And the person that's saying that, here's the evidence that they are actually working for the Russian government. Now, that's counter speech. So in other words, the solution to misinformation is true information. And let's take the second example. Someone comes out and they say, in order to stop, prevent the transmission of the virus, you should drink a little bit of bleach every morning. And they're saying that. And maybe they're a doctor and they're saying it. That's horrible. What if people drank bleach? They would kill themselves. It'd be horrible. What's the solution to that? The solution to that is for other people to say, that's wrong. If you drink bleach, you will hurt yourself and you might die. This person is a quack. You should not drink bleach. And so there's something you might say, well, but there's some people that might still drink the bleach. Well, sure. I mean, there's people that do all sorts of dumb things. In fact, I was just at the Supreme Court on Monday And Ketanji Brown Jackson argued, she said, well, what if people are promoting the jumping out of windows and then kids start jumping out of windows? Doesn't the government have a responsibility to stop people from encouraging people from jumping out of windows? Well, first of all, this is a very interesting choice of topics because I happen to watch videos of people jumping out of windows. It's called parkour. It's one of my favorite kinds of videos. People jump out of windows. I just watched one the other day. It's beautiful. A guy jumps out of a window and grabs a big light pole and slides down like three stories. It's important for people to say that amateurs should not attempt this. But the solution, once again, is counter speech. Let me make it an even stronger case. Let's say that let's say the government says we're going to censor all of that pro-Russia propaganda. We're going to censor it. Well, or we're going to censor all the Nazi propaganda. Well, here's a problem. Then it pushes it underground and there's no chance to properly refute it. I think as a society, we want to be able to explain why Nazism is bad or why the Russian invasion of Ukraine is bad, if you think it's bad. I want to be able to educate people. So in other words, education requires people expressing bad ideas. In fact, I personally must express bad ideas for me to have to come to a good idea. Most of us have the experience, good ideas never come out fully born. You come out half-baked or wrong ideas. We know that being creative requires expressing yourself and hearing other people's bad ideas, and that the truth emerges in an organic process. It's not something that comes from a centralized authority. So free speech is fundamental to a democratic society and to being able to cut through what's a good idea and a bad idea.
Okay. I want to, again, continue in the spirit of devil's advocate and question whether we can rely upon more speech to be the antidote to poisonous speech. It's like an open marketplace, and we think competition is going to bring us to a, you know, as an economist, I would say, to some kind of efficient equilibrium or something like that. And then stuff can go wrong. Stuff can go wrong in the marketplace where you might have monopoly power or some other thing, and stuff can go wrong in the marketplace for ideas where you might have pressures on people not to say what they really think, and virtue signaling and moralizing and things of this kind that are have a social function quite apart from the truth or falsity of claims, but have to do with being, I mean, for example, there are two wars going on. There are more than two wars going on. There's a war in Ukraine and there's a war in Israel-Gaza. Something tells me that the range of discussion of the issues that those wars raise is delimited and constrained by the fact that one has to be very careful what one says without, you know, being associated with some morally problematic position. You don't want people to think that you're on, you know, I mean, it's all kinds of stuff. It could be a political campaign where one candidate, Trump, could be saying one thing and another candidate saying the opposite thing. And I don't want to be thought to be associated with that kind. Or it could be, just like they'll call you a racist if you oppose, you know, police reform or something. They call you an anti-Semite if you just say something about Gaza or Hamas. They'll say that you're a Putin apologist if you say, you know, whatever. And that keeps the marketplace from for ideas from, you know, and these mobs, these mobs that start going after people and these boycott impetus to try to, you know, cancel, you know, people's livelihood and destroy their reputations, things of this kind. That's all my dump of an idea, which is self-censorship and social status imperatives and legitimacy. You know, and who gets to control this thing? I mean, they control the words. You try using the word apartheid in a certain context. You try using the word genocide in a certain context. Oh, you're a Hamas apologist, are you? Well, no, I'm not, actually. You see what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that these two things go together. In other words, we saw cancel culture emerging clearly fed by, related to social media technologies, the ways in which they I think, fed the narcissism, which is basically narcissism. One of the most important parts of it is entitlement. And what you see, if you think somebody who thinks that they should be able to shut you up, either on a college campus or on a social media platform, you are expressing a lot of entitlement, particularly in the United States, where that has not been our tradition. Clearly, that emerges sometime around 2010, about a decade ago. It really emerges strongly in the culture. There was that cancel culture existed before, but it gets put on steroids with social media. I think the other factor that Jonathan Haidt obviously talks about is the coddling of the American mind. The coddling of young people results in a sense of entitlement, that it's not just that you say your thing, I say my thing, I think you're wrong, you think I'm wrong, fine, it'll all work itself out. No, no, you should not be allowed to express your views. That then, after 2016, starts to show up among government officials who are working for government agencies, the Department of Homeland Security, FBI, you know, other government agencies, where they start to work with third-party groups to basically create a very elaborate set of bureaucracies. Really, Stanford University is something called the Stanford Internet Observatory. They start monitoring speech online. They start hyping the threat of so-called disinformation. They even talk about something called peer-to-peer misinformation. So at first, we're supposed to be scared of Russians. And then they say, well, it turns out a lot of the misinformation is coming from ordinary Americans. Yeah. I mean, you start to kind of go, whoa, wait, what are we talking about here? Talking about people you don't agree with. And I think there's some of it's just a shock of the technology. You know, we didn't realize how much the conversation in the United States of America was controlled by a couple of big newspapers and the major TV networks, and how much the state government exercised control over what was considered acceptable. Once you get social media technology, and the Overton window, which is this famous concept of describing acceptable discourse, suddenly it's much broader. It opens it up. It's much challenged. So this is, we named our Substack publication Public after Martin Gurry's famous book, Revolt of the Public, which is about the rise of the internet in general and social media in particular, and then the backlash from the elites, from the establishment that you mentioned earlier. And we've seen these two things coming together. On the one hand, there's a grassroots cancel culture, and at the same time, there's a government involvement in the creation of a censorship industrial complex. The people in that complex have the same views as the people in cancel culture mobs. The difference is they now have state power. They're working for government agencies. They have huge budgets. And some of them are also tied to the intelligence community. And that's where things get really scary. That's precisely, in our view, and also in the view of this book, Ponerology, that's how you get something that looks like totalitarianism.
Okay. Do you see a connection between the censorship problematic, all those things that you were talking about on the one hand, and these other areas that you were alluding to, climate alarmism and the sicko problem, the unwillingness or inability to articulate a framework of moral assessment and prudence that is commensurate to the problems that our modern civilization are facing, and therefore a kind of dissolution of the things falling apart kind of feeling. I mean, do you see a connection between those?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm still trying to piece it all together. But I mean, the first thing to know is there are U.S. government-funded think tanks. I'll give you one example, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. It's not that well known in the United States. It's in London. It's funded by the U.S. government, funded by the British government, funded by NATO, that has sought to identify and censor so-called misinformation on a range of issues: climate change, transgenderism, the war in Ukraine, so-called hate speech. We released a set of internal files from the main transgender health organization that show very clear medical mistreatment and misdiagnosis.
That was the WPATH thing?
The WPATH files.
Yeah. Please talk about that for a little bit.
Well, I give the example because it's very important in medical mistreatment scandals that you be allowed to talk about them. And, you know, that, I mean, it seems obvious, but like, these are internal files that show that doctors and surgeons and therapists are giving surgeries, genital surgeries, and heavy, hard drugs to children as young as 14 years old, to seriously mentally ill people, including people with schizophrenia, to people that are also, you know, diagnosed with anxiety disorders, and that they themselves know and talk about how the children, adolescents, and vulnerable adults and their parents do not understand that they are going to be sterile for life, that they're going to lose sexual function, and that they say, we don't know how to make a 14-year-old understand this. I mean, this is very, very shocking information because informed consent is right up there with do no harm when it comes to medical ethics. Well, we released these files.
How did the files come to be public?
Somebody or some people gave them to us, gave them to me. They knew of my work on the Twitter files. And so we wrote a 70-page report to accompany 170 pages of files. Twitter, before Elon, famously censored people for not using preferred pronouns, meaning somebody named Megan Murphy was censored for saying to a former censorship official, a trust and safety professional at Twitter, Megan said, but a man is not a woman, though. And she was deplatformed for saying a man is not a woman. If Elon Musk had not been the head of Twitter, I mean, my WPATH files, the original post on Twitter, I believe it now has something like 17,000 retweets, and it's been viewed by 7 million people. Under the old Twitter, I am very confident that that would have been censored. Yeah. How do you get reform? How do you get social change of any kind if you're not allowed to have free speech? That's scary to me. And that's when and Elon is game changing in terms of allowing a free speech platform. But you see on all these issues,
So transgenderism is one of the issues. Climate is another one of the issues. And what are some of the war stories about climate? Suppression of information and speech.
Well, I can speak from my own experience. Apocalypse Never, HarperCollins published Apocalypse Never in June 2020. A so-called fact-check organization fact-checked the article I wrote to promote the book. There was nothing factually incorrect about anything in that. What they said was it's misleading, meaning Michael's article is misleading because Michael is not being sufficiently alarmist. Most people know, I think climate change is real. I think it's caused by humans. I think we should do something about it. I've fought to keep nuclear plants open because I care about it. But I also don't think it's apocalypse. I don't think it's the end of the world. And I'm disturbed that children are being given a lot of anxiety by their teachers and by society around climate. So Facebook fact checkers said Michael's book is misleading. Facebook censored it. They censored this article. Now, which, you know, I will say there is one of the best antidotes to censorship is something known as the Streisand effect, which is that named after Barbara Streisand when she tried to stop a photo of her home from being on the internet. As soon as she sued to keep the photo from being viewed, it became a worldwide story and everybody looked at Barbara Streisand's home on the internet. So I did benefit from the Streisand effect because I went on to Twitter, which, you know, by the way, I will say was a freer platform than Facebook even before Elon took it over. So I went on to X, at the time Twitter, and I said, I've been censored on Facebook, and this is outrageous, and I didn't say anything incorrect. And even if I had said something incorrect, the proper response would be to argue with me, not to censor me. And then I think thanks to some of that, at least the book became a bestseller. So censorship has is a double-edged sword for the people engaged in the censorship. But what we saw with COVID and on gender and a whole set of other issues was really silent censorship, repressing the virality of information, putting people on blacklists. Dr. Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford University, one of the world's great epidemiologists, was put on a blacklist at Twitter. He had no idea. So the worst forms of censorship are often completely unknown. I was lucky in a sense in that I knew I was being censored. But what's much more terrifying is governments working with social media platforms to essentially repress stories so that you might still see it, like you would tweet something, but not that many people would see it. It's not allowed to go viral.
Did you have interactions with Elon Musk?
Yeah, so, I mean, my relationship with Elon is, so it was Barry Weiss that was the second reporter that was invited by somebody at Twitter to go up there and look at the Twitter files. Barry knew I live in Berkeley, so I'm across the bay from Twitter, which is in San Francisco. Barry invited me in. People sometimes say Elon invited me in. He didn't. And I should say, I actually criticize Elon Musk in Apocalypse Never. I disagree with his views of solar panels. And so I actually had criticized Elon in Apocalypse Never. And so I was a little awkward about meeting him. Nice to meet you. But he didn't know who I was. And so then we got into the Twitter files. And I have had a chance to get to know him. We're friendly. We're not friends. I have subscribers now on X. And you are on Substack, so you know how it works. I give away some content and I paywall some content, and I do the same thing on X. So my relationship with Elon right now is I'm definitely rooting for him as a free speech CEO and owner of X. At the same time, I'm also doing business on X. I have 2,000 subscribers on X. They pay the exact same amount. So people that you can subscribe to me on Substack, or you can subscribe to me on X. And so we have that relationship. But he's obviously one of the most interesting people in the world. I mean, it's just incredible. It's an incredibly humbling experience to be able to meet people like that. It's amazing that people like that exist. And I will go further and say, we had hoped the Supreme Court would be on our side in a big censorship case that was just heard on Monday this week.
Oh, this is the Murphy versus Missouri case?
That's right.
Yeah, what's that about?
Well, this is about this government involvement in censorship of social media platforms. And it was going on. It was basically the Twitter files were describing the same thing. And so the question turned on, well, there's a bunch of different parts of it. But basically, the Supreme Court heard the case. Our side, I don't think, argued it particularly well, but nonetheless, it was clear the Supreme Court justices, they didn't know what the difference was between a publication like the New York Times and a social media platform like X. They also, I think, didn't really appreciate the First Amendment. I mean, Ketanji Jackson Brown, as I mentioned, said, it seems like the First Amendment constrains the government when it could be helping people by censoring videos of people jumping out of windows. I mean, it was a completely bizarre experience. What was happening is that the Department of Homeland Security, it was a variety of things, but if I'll simplify a little bit, the Department of Homeland Security asked Stanford Institute Observatory and others to create a censorship initiative to basically, you know, flag content that they viewed as wrong, flag it for the platforms, take it to the platforms, and get the platforms to take it down or de-amplify it, which is to reduce the virality. The law is very clear on one point, which is that the government can't have somebody do something for it. It's still illegal.
That it can't do itself.
That it can't do itself. The government cannot limit freedom of speech. That's the First Amendment. So the government can't ask Stanford to censor and limit speech. Yeah. Now, the response then says, well, it's up to Facebook and Twitter whether they're going to censor the speech. The government's not making them. Now that sounds right. The problem is, in practice, to give one example among many, when Facebook was considering a White House request to censor often true stories, that was their language, often true stories of vaccine side effects, Facebook's own social scientist said, we know from the research that if we censor stories of vaccine side effects, it will increase vaccine hesitancy. If people know, if people see that things are being censored, they're going to wonder, they're going to think that you're covering something up. So it's much better to just allow the conversation to occur. This was from Facebook. That person in Facebook was overruled by a senior executive named Nick Clegg, who was a former British politician. And Nick Clegg said, you know, we're going to have to go ahead and do the censorship because we need the White House support to deal with the Europeans on a pressing business matter. So what you have is effectively the government engaging in limiting speech on the Facebook platform simply because there were no threats made. Nobody at the White House said to Facebook, we won't help you with the Europeans if you don't censor. That was already present for the senior executive at Facebook. So we wrote an amicus brief, and we have a brilliant lawyer, Adam Candube, who opened with this famous story of King Henry the, oh gosh, King Henry II, like 500 years ago, who said, famously, I think it may be apocryphal, but he said something like, in earshot of his knights, he said something like, will nobody rid me of this troublesome priest, referring to an archbishop. Yeah. The knights then went and killed the priest, and eventually the king was held to account for basically asking these guys to kill the priest. And that has established this precedent. The government cannot ask somebody to do something that it is not allowed to do itself. So we think that's the case should have been a slam dunk in our corner. But I'm afraid I don't think that our side made the case particularly well. And I think we're probably not going to succeed in the Supreme Court, which means that we're all the more dependent on Elon Musk to maintain X as a social media platform, because I don't think the Supreme Court is coming to the rescue.
You say Ukraine is another one of the subject areas where there's a concern about censorship. How so?
Well, another Twitter Files author and my friend Lee Fong, they have these conferences where people get together and talk about how to fight misinformation, meaning censor online. And he interviewed somebody from the Ukrainian military who said, and he just spoke very frankly to Lee, and the guy said, yeah, when we see Russian misinformation or misinformation about the war in Ukraine, we just ask the FBI to take it up with Facebook, and then Facebook will take it down. I mean, if that's not a violation of the First Amendment, I don't know what is. I mean, that's insane, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, what's really scary, Glenn, is governments have a lot of money. I mean, you may know that the black budget, meaning the hidden secret budget of the CIA and the intelligence community, it's just massive. It's billions of dollars. So there's all this, you know, there's all this public money, government money going to groups like Aspen Institute, Stanford Internet Observatory, the Atlantic Council, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, all these think tanks. And those think tanks then produce reports basically demonizing people for all the stuff that we were just talking about. Basically being critical of the war in Ukraine, being politically incorrect on a variety of issues. It's mostly aimed at the populist right. It's counter-populism is the main dynamic, but it's also been aimed at the radical left. So you do have some radical left, pro-Russia supporters who have been absolutely demonized and censored as well. So, and we had hoped, I should say, we had hoped that when you saw this big demand to censor pro-Palestinian voices, mostly on the left, we had hoped that the left would say, oh, okay, I changed my mind. We don't want the government involved in censorship. To some extent, that's occurred. But so mostly the censorship is, the demands for censorship are mostly coming from the left against the right. But the heavy dynamic is really, it's coming from the establishment, it's coming from the state. demands to censor these populist voices. It's just crystal clear from a variety of initiatives and variety of people that after 2016, there's a famous meeting at the White House that we have heard multiple people say that occurred in early 17 before Obama left, that somebody says, some senior government official says, we don't want a repeat of 2016. And they meant both the election of Trump and the Brexit election. The establishment viewed the rise of social media as an absolute threat to their legitimacy and their ability to rule. And that's where so much of this comes from. But of course, still building on that cancel culture that had been growing up until then.
What did you think of the way in which the civil disturbances in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd in 2020 was covered? How do you think the information system dealt with the ability for people to actually get facts in an unfettered way about what was happening? Was there a problem there, in your view?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I mentioned, it's like I was watching you and John. It was like a moment of some, just a little bit of a little oasis of sanity among mass insanity. I mean, obviously your viewers all lived through it and you've talked about it, you know, to death. So I don't know that I have, you know, too much to add to it. You know, I will say it had a religious quality to it. You know, John's book, when I read Woke Racism, I was just like, oh, well, it really completes for me the sense in which wokeism is definitely a religion. And you were in the midst of a kind of fanaticism. It was, I mean, for me, the signature moment is when the Black Lives Matter mob in Washington, D.C., holding their fists over this middle-aged woman at a cafe, demanding that she raise her fist in what felt at that point like a fascist salute. I mean, it was unbelievable. There's this photo. And of course, you may remember from there's a video that was shot, and the black activists in Black Lives Matter said, no, the white activists should go to the front of the mob. And there's the scene of them holding their fist over her. That, for me, those behaviors, I'm not diagnosing the people, but those behaviors are what you would call antisocial behaviors, or what less politically correct term would be psychopathic behaviors, meaning behaviors defined as not caring about the impact on the person that's being bullied in that instance, a real dehumanization of that person. And then also the other characteristic of psychopathy, of psychopaths, is their fearlessness. You know, and to some extent, that's a good trait to have. I think psychopathy in some ways is on the opposite end of a spectrum as neuroticism. But the fearlessness of, and also then the narcissism, the entitlement, I have the right to demand that you raise your fist. You're having a glass, the woman's having a glass of wine at a cafe.
Yeah.
Turned out, she said later, the woman who was being bullied, she said later she had marched with Black Lives Matter. She was concerned about police violence. I mean, that's just the tactics. I mean, the other thing you know very well, and I think you guys talked about, is that there's just not an epidemic of police killing unarmed black men in the United States. That just doesn't exist. It's something around 10 to 20, you know, bad incidents a year where the police are involved in what's called an unjustified killing. And I think you've had Roland Fryer on, or you were a mentor to Roland Fryer. I heard Roland in University of Austin describing this. But when you actually look at the data, there is no increase. There's a decrease. We looked at FBI data for San Francisco. It's not a big part of the book, but we looked at FBI data from the 1970s until today. And sure enough, the police have gotten better at the use of force. They don't use violence or shooting as much. So the whole premise of the entire thing was just such a lie, you know? And then for the tactics to have been so psychopathological, and for the whole thing to have been fed by the media, you know, and created by the media, clearly had a political agenda. Awful period in American history.
Oh, you've responded to my prompt very effectively as to what, with the anecdote, but the anecdote is powerful as to what was wrong with the way in which the information system covered those events. But I move to ask why. I mean, you know, I mean, because it's not just censorship. It's not just somebody wanted to tell that story and the lords of the media shut it down. It's that the narrative, you know, mostly peaceful protest and the sort of identification of the Black Lives Matter protest with struggle, with resistance, with, you know, I mean, that's a more insidious kind of corruption, it seems to me, than simply not allowing somebody to say something which is true, but you're censoring them. And I wonder, do you have any thoughts about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, how far down the rabbit hole do you go, right? I think that Jonathan Haidt's observation that one big difference between liberals and conservatives is that conservatives have held on to a set of fundamentally traditional older values like loyalty, sanctity, purity, authority. I'm not sure if I'm making them all right. Freedom. And that the left has really opted out of all those older values towards a single value of care and compassion. Now, in San Francisco, I offer an amendment to John Haidt's incredible observation by saying that actually the left has those older values, but they are only for victims, for people they've classified as victims, not for people they've classified as oppressors. So people sometimes ask me, they go, if the left is all about, you know, anarchy and just allowing people to use drugs publicly, camp publicly, you know, deal drugs, do, you know, smoke fentanyl, die on the streets, if it's this radical left libertarianism, then why are they imposing lockdowns and vaccine mandates? How do you explain that? And it's easy to understand when you understand that it's for people they've classified as victims. For every, they should have everything and nothing should be required. People they've classified as oppressors should be denied everything. So the freedom is freedom, and also authority, loyalty, sanctity, purity. That's all for victims. But for everybody else, for the oppressors, they should be denied those things. I do think it comes out of, though, a sense, and even the compassion. So the compassion is obviously not for the woman trying to have a glass of wine at that Washington, D.C. cafe to whom they're demanding the salute. There's no care or compassion for her. There's actually just cruelty and dehumanization. So I think that does a lot of the explaining. Then you have to ask, how do you get that wokeism? How do you get that woke totalitarianism? How do you get that hardness, the dogmatism? Where does it come from? Well, I think I agree with John, and I think you, which is that wokeism is a religion. It has at least three big parts of it. Climate change, it offers an alternative view of the apocalypse, climate change offers an alternative picture. It offers an alternative God. You used to have to get right by God. Now you have to get right by nature and climate change, and we have to reorder society based on climate change. It offers a new moral hierarchy. BIPOC, you can see who's on top, who's on bottom. And then in terms of the gender, it offers a new soul. You're born with a particular gendered soul. And so you have a kind of a complete religion. Why do we have wokeism in the first place? Well, because it turns out there's some of my friends like Steve Pinker and Michael Shermer and Richard Dawkins, who I don't know, but you know, you have some really good liberal atheists who have resisted wokeism. But many people need to believe in a religion. I mean, I think that's obvious. And a lot of people, when you tell them that you're just worm food, that your life has no inherent meaning, that you're just an animal like all other animals, you have no soul, there is no afterlife, there is no God, all of this stuff is just random and you're pretty insignificant, I think that is psychologically very difficult for people. And there's a famous book called The Denial of Death, which argues that the fear of death sublimates into a lot of creativity, including religions. But I think that's a big part of what's going on, that we're dealing with a crisis of nihilism as predicted perfectly by Nietzsche in the 19th century, that crisis of nihilism would result in, and it did, it resulted in communism and fascism. And when those two ideologies were defeated in reality and ideologically, then you gave rise to a new religion, which is what we would call wokeism. And so for me, this is really an old problem, an old story, which is that the older myths, the idea that America is this shining city on a hill, the idea that the United States is this incredible thing, that we're all so lucky to be here, that's gone. And the new story is that this is all just, we're all just contaminated by this awful history of genocide and white supremacy and racism, and that we're all filled with this guilt. So for me, it's all a single, I mean, Shelby Steele's, you know, brilliant work, your work, John's work, white guilt.
Well, these
these are substitutes for older stories of guilt and redemption. But now we're left with this deeply nihilistic, woke ideology that's resulting in what I think is creeping, incipient totalitarianism.
Well, that's a very grim picture. We're in the age of disillusionment, and I don't see a way out. I see what you're against. I don't know what you're for. I mean, I don't suppose you're advocating a return to religious faith. You can't go back again on that, it seems to me. So what is the counter to this nihilism, in your view?
Well, that is the big question. I mean, there's only two big questions, right? Which is, why are civilized people undermining civilization, and what do you do about it?
Yeah.
I think that, so the response from the right has traditionally been traditional values, family, country,
yeah,
God. I agree with you, though. I don't think Michael Shermer, Steve Pinker, and Richard Dawkins are on board on the God train. I do have a faith, personally. I get a lot from my faith, but I am not an evangelical, and I need and want to be in a political coalition with atheists. I mean, I'll start with them, Hindus, Jews, Muslims. I want them all in a big coalition. So what is the foundation of that political coalition? Here's where I am landing right now, and I would love your reaction to it. I think that once you get to the nihilism and you go, the nihilism is really at the bottom of it, and there's a kind of hedonism in the destruction. There's a pleasure in holding your fist over that girl and making her hold up her fist. There's a pleasure in burning down the local liquor store.
Yeah.
That's it. And it's a dehumanizing, it's anti-human. I mean, climate, I mean, all of these woke ideologies are making humans wrong. They're making civilization wrong and America wrong, but they're saying there's something really bad about humans. I would say that's where we start. I want to start by affirming the specialness of human beings and this is, you'll detect the irony, because I haven't forgotten my Nietzsche. Even though I am a Christian, I do still think Nietzsche offers enormous insights. Nietzsche says, you must affirm humans and all of our, the full humans in all of our good and badness, he would say. And you affirm humans, you affirm life. And if you're pro-human, then that means you must be pro-civilization, because nothing has been better for humans than civilization. And if you believe in human freedom, then you also must support liberal democracy, so that the foundation of a new political coalition, one that I think draws a huge amount of support from the right, and I think gets you, to put it in kind of crass political terms, a lot of swing voters and a lot of anti-woke liberals, of whom I still consider myself one, and Michael Shermer and Steve Pinker, I think, and Richard Dawkins are in that category. On a good day, Sam Harris. But that is a pro-human, pro-civilization platform. It's cheap energy, law and order, meritocracy, free and fair elections, free speech, equal justice under the law. It's got to be pro-natalist. It's got to, I mean, there is no future to humankind if nobody's having children anymore. So you've got to, and this is something I really do admire about Elon. He has personally done his part to repopulate the country. I mean, he's made the case for this. I hasten to add, and I'll upset my conservative friends and hopefully please my liberal friends, I believe that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. but I'm pro-natalist. I think we should encourage people to have kids. If we need to pay people, we should do that. But I think that for me, I go, that feels like a majority coalition, pro-human, pro-civilization. I'll tell you, people don't like crime. They don't want to be victims of crime. They like the police. They know you want more police. Even in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, in the radical, in Oakland, they now know you want the police. They can't even operate restaurants. I think it was Taco Bell. They had to just do drive-through because they had too much crime in the restaurants. We need police. Police are good. More police, better. That actually allows you to get rid of the bad police. For me, that's where I land. I think trying to build all this on a common faith or a common belief in God, that goes too far. It's you're going to shrink the coalition. Let's build a coalition on being pro-human and pro-civilization and pro-liberal democracy.
Okay. We can close in a few minutes, but I wanted to dig a little bit deeper. Pro-human, pro-civilization, is that enough to resolve some of the questions? You think cheap energy. So pro-human, pro-civilization means the industrial base that we have, and notwithstanding the risk to the climate, I know you've dealt with that. What about capitalism versus socialism or some kind of more collective? What about the nation state versus international governance? And how does pro-American align itself with pro-civilization and pro-human? And if so, what does that say about the conflicts between different centers of power in the world political community, stuff like that? Not that you can answer all of that in 5 minutes, but.
No, I mean, I think if you're pro liberal democratic civilization, then nobody has done it better than the United States of America. Is it pro-capitalist? Yes, with the caveat that there's a powerful state that has played a wonderful role on things like Social Security and Medicare, and we need to have a functioning state. I think there is justification for, I'm a Hamiltonian nationalist. I'm an economic nationalist. I think it's good for countries to think of themselves as in competition to the world. The world is, it's a global competition. I think that there's a lot of romanticism that people have projected. So I favor trade. I favor alliances. I support NATO. I support the Western Alliance. But I think that the globalization agenda has gone too far. And I think I am pro-American. And I do think that that's part of the basis of a pro-human, pro-civilization, pro-American coalition. I don't think Democrats want to be on the side of anti-Americans, of pro-globalization. I do think that the West is reverting back to a kind of nationalism, but it's never, I don't think it's going to, I think there was an overreaction by elites. I don't think Trump is going to abandon NATO. I don't think he should. I don't think he will. We don't need.
He's making noises like that.
He makes noises, and then really when you look at it, he just kind of wants the Europeans to pay more for their own security, yeah. Which they should. And they should, and Germany probably need, they need to have their own weapons and they need to have their own soldiers. And I think we're in a period, it's 75 years after World War II. I think that I think things are recalibrating. I'm an optimist. So I think things are going to be okay. I want to make as deep of a criticism and a diagnosis of the ills as possible, but I also think appealing to free speech, appealing to liberal democracy, people are rushing into our country because we're still the greatest country in the world. I still think that works. So, and I think that, look, I think most people prefer Martin Luther King to Ibram Kendi. I just think people prefer I Have a Dream to we're going to create a race-based hierarchy. It's just awful. And you've done, literally, I can't.
I agree with that. And I return to my question because I think that's really a winning argument. Who are the American race heroes in the scope of the 200 plus years? Ibram X. Kendi and the Black Lives Matter women don't rank in that calculation relative to some of these towering figures like King or Frederick Douglass or Bayard Rustin or whatever.
Yeah.
So why? Who's in control of the narrative, and how is it that that account? And I have an essay out there called "The Case for Black Patriotism," where I basically say we African Americans. I mean, the Americanness is the most important thing. I mean, what a bequest! Mm. Birthright citizenship in the greatest republic in the history of the planet. What a bequest! You know, we're not third world people. We're not Africans. We are descended from Africans. We're not Africans. So to not embrace that, to go around with my fist balled up and, you know, my hair trigger ready to be offended and without a willingness to, you said narcissism, without to let go of my little story and embrace this larger story, you know. So, I definitely think that, but this is a minority voice, at the New York Times editorial page or other such venues.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a minority in the professional managerial class, in the elite establishment institutions for sure. But you may have seen, I was super heartened by it, this recent Financial Times poll or graph showing how many racial minorities in the United States are leaving the Democrats.
Yeah,
I saw and that. I mean, this is the absolute opposite of what was predicted, right? Trump was going to shrink the Republican Party because all the Latinos were going to leave. Well, now right. It's not just African Americans and Latinos are going to the Republican Party. I say this, by the way, as a political independent. I'm actually very happy to be a journalist, and I'm not engaging in politics. I'm not going to endorse anybody, but nonetheless, the people keep disobeying. The American people keep disobeying the establishment. And boy, what a beautiful sight that is to see. It really actually gives me incredible hope in the American people that the elites keep telling the people what reality is, what the truth is. They keep demanding. And then you get these swerves, you know, to borrow from Lucretius, you know, you get these swerves of reality where somebody like Elon Musk, I would never have, even a few years ago, I would have never imagined be praising a billionaire for buying Twitter, but he bought Twitter. And as far as we can tell, he's doing his best to keep it a free speech platform. So you get these crazy, wonderful surprises. So I don't think at all, when I tell that story about not, you know, nihilism and the way it's been growing and the woke religion, that totalitarianism, I agree with all that. But then there's just this wonderful, wonderful realities where you get these incredible swerves. We have a free speech platform. African Americans and Latinos in the United States are rejecting what the elites are telling them. You know, I spend a fair amount of time in Europe, and I love Europe, and there is so much more intellectual energy and firepower coming from the United States right now. I mean, there's so much from, you've got this book by Abigail Schreier, you've got the Jonathan Haidt book, you had John's book, your book is coming out. I'm reading this new book by Rob Henderson. I mean, so We are, you know, and it's all coming from, I guess you'd call it the center, right? You know, you'd say, or the anti-woke liberals. It's super exciting time to be a public intellectual, to be an investigative journalist. The fact that the news media is all propaganda, I'm just happy as a clam because I'm doing investigative reporting. And like, it appears that all my competitors in the mainstream media are going to leave all this amazing reporting to us. So, I mean, I'll leave it there and just say, look, I'm absolutely, and the technology allows me to talk to people like you and allows new institutions to form. So, I mean, I sometimes wake up and I'm just like, you know, America's not going to make it. And, you know, the totalitarianism is too strong in the intelligence community and the fascists are too strong. And then other days I go, no, this country's got a lot more left in it.
Yeah, I sure hope you're right about that. It's a good note to end on. Thanks very much, Michael. Michael Schellenberger, who is a new faculty member at the University of Austin, UATX, and Twitter Files extraordinaire participant and author of of apocalypse never and on environmental extremism and of San Francisco on the inadequacies of policies toward the homeless in that city. And my guests here at the Glenn Show, I really thank you for your time, Mike.
Thank you, Glenn. It was a real pleasure.